Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, so here's how we're going to do it. We're going to read all the way through verses 12 through 17, and then we'll come back and we'll work from verse 12, and we'll work through the passage together. All right, everybody ready?
Yes.
Thank you, Miss Jackie. I appreciate it. We need somebody over here. Y'all over here on this side to match the energy, okay? All right, here we go. Verse 12. And Jesus entered the temple and drove out all who sold and bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. He said to them, "It is written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer,' but you make it a den of robbers." And the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them. But when the chief priests and the scribes saw the wonderful things that he did, and the children crying out in the temple, "Hosanna to the Son of David," they were indignant. Verse 16. And they said to him, "Do you hear what these are saying?" And Jesus said to them, "Yes. Have you never read, 'Out of the mouth of infants and nursing babies, you have prepared praise'?" Last one, verse 17. And leaving them, he went out of the city to Bethany and lodged there. All right, so this is one of the more famous stories in the Bible, simply because it occurs in all four of the Gospels. Now, if you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you will see that it occurs the last week of Jesus' earthly life, earthly ministry, before the cross. If you read John's Gospel, you will see that it occurs in chapter 2, which means it is at the beginning. Right? So we have some decisions to make, which leads us to another Bible reading principle. Okay, so this is free seminary you're getting right here this morning, all right? So here's what I mean. Remember several weeks ago we talked about some Bible reading principles. Do you remember them? Here's one of them. Number one, you don't read single verses, you read... There you go, that's good enough. Paragraphs. You don't read single verses, you read paragraphs. And it's better if you read chapters, or it's even maybe best if you read to the scene change, right? Which means you got to read closely. Don't read single verses, read paragraphs. All right, paragraphs. That's Bible reading principle number one. Here's number two. Whenever you see the word "therefore," you're supposed to ask, what is it therefore? Which will, in essence, always be what is previous to what you're about to read. That whatever comes after the therefore is based off of what you just read. All right, Bible reading principle number three. Always look for verbs, because verbs carry action. All right, now, so those are the three we've already been over. Here's the one for today. Bible reading principle number four. You ready? The Gospels, blow your mind. The Gospels are not strict histories. Whoa. Well, if they're not strict histories, what are they? Here's what they are. They are theological histories. What I mean by that is, each of the Gospels, we could spend a whole sermon just on this, I promise. Each of the Gospels has a theological point the author is trying to make. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are not writing a strict chronological history about the life of Jesus. No, they are making a point about who Jesus is. I'll give you a great example. The Christmas story. Two gospel writers talk about the Christmas story. Matthew and Luke. I want to ask you a question. This is not rhetorical. Feel free. You can shout out the answer. In Matthew's gospel, who visits Jesus when he's born? It's in Matthew chapter 2. You can look right now if you want. Who is it? You only have two choices. You have a 50-50 shot. Not the shepherds. The wise men. Great. Good job, Ben. You get a gold star. All right. I'm sure others said he was just loudest. All right. So, the wise men visit Jesus. Now, what do the wise men give Jesus? Gifts. Gold. Frankincense and myrrh. I know, it's like March and we're thinking about spring, not Christmas. I should have done this at Christmas, right? Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. All are gifts for a king. Guess what Matthew's gospel is about? Jesus is king of the Jews. Huh, interesting how that works out, isn't it? And you will see that over and over and over again because Matthew, do you know why Matthew's the first book in the New Testament? Because Jesus is king of the Jews. And what's the Old Testament directed at? Jews. That's why Matthew, we saw, hey, I told you we would see it again last week. It says, it is written. What did it say here? What did Jesus quote? Do you not know it is written? Matthew's gospel is first because Matthew all over and over and over again has Jesus and others saying, and him as an author saying, it is written, which means they're going back to the Old Testament. That's why Matthew is first in your New Testament. It's not because he wrote it first. That is not the first book written in the New Testament by any stretch of the imagination. It's one of the last books written in the New Testament period. Right? But that's why. Now, let me give you an answer. All right, you've already got half of it right. Who visits Jesus in Luke's gospel? Not the wise men, but the shepherds. Great job. Shepherds. Who were the shepherds? High class folk? Low class folk? Low class folk. Let me ask you another question. Who does Jesus say, hey, come down out of that tree, I'm going to your house today? Zacchaeus. Where does that story happen? What gospel? Luke. Over and over and over again, you see Jesus interacting with all types of people in Luke's gospel. You want to know why? Because Luke's theological point that he is trying to make is that Jesus is not just king of the Jews, like Matthew, but that Jesus is king of the world. Right? So Luke has stories and is pointing us to a theological point, not a strict chronological history. Mark and John do the same exact thing. So, when you read Mark's version of this story, here's what you're going to read. You're going to read that actually, after Jesus entered the Jerusalem compound at the triumphal entry that we talked about last week, remember palm trees? People lay cloaks and sticks and all that in the road. He rode in on a donkey, and we talked about it last week how it was a Roman-style victory parade, but the people kind of misjudged what he was really there for. He wasn't a king like they thought he was. He wasn't going to throw Pilate and the Romans out and start a Jewish state. He was going to be king of their hearts and lives and of a heavenly kingdom, right? Well, Mark's gospel tells us that it was late in the day after he entered Jerusalem and Jesus and his disciples returned to Bethany. Now, let's think about it. It probably was. Does anybody remember how far Jericho was? 6 to 7 hour walk. And they stopped in Bethpage to get a donkey and a colt. Then they went over amongst the throngs of people into Jerusalem, probably late in the day. Now, Matthew doesn't record that part. He makes it as Jesus just immediately goes in the temple. Is Matthew lying to us? No. Because he's writing a theological history about Jesus, not a strict day by day. On day one, Jesus did this. And on day two, Jesus did that. And you say, well, how can he do that? Because the rules of writing a theological history are not the rules that you and I would be governed by to write a history today. If you and I write a history today, we better get it in chronological order, right? Because that's the rules that we live under. The rules that Matthew is writing and Mark and Luke and John, they don't apply to them because they have different sets of rules for the literature that they're writing. So here's what probably happened. Yes, Jesus left and went to Bethany. So the story we're reading today happens on not Sunday, but Monday. And if you read Mark's gospel, what you'll see is that on the way into town, Jesus sees a fig tree and he curses the fig tree. And then he walks into Jerusalem, cleanses the temple, which we're going to talk about. And then as he comes back out, there's this action about the fig tree again. All right. Now, Mark's gospel intentionally sets the story up today that way. But we're in Matthew, so let's talk about Matthew. So, in verse number 12 of Matthew's gospel, Jesus enters the temple. Now, he enters the temple, and what does it tell us? Remember, we're looking for verbs. What does it tell us? What are the verbs? He drove out and overturned tables of money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. So let's talk about it for a minute. That word drove out literally means to expel by force. Jesus ain't going, hey guys, hey, need y'all to get out of here. No, Jesus is like fervently pushing them. John's gospel tells us that he fashions a hasty cord, like a whip. Now, when I read this as a kid, I thought of like Indiana Jones and a bullwhip going, that's not. It was more like reeds that he wove together really quickly, and so it was like floppy. You know, it's to push the animals out, basically, right? And so Jesus is pushing everybody out, right? Now, in a minute, we're going to talk about how big the temple is, right? But the question we've got to ask first is this. Why in the world are there money changers, and why are there animals in the temple? Right? Because like this, it'd be like if it would be like on Sunday morning, if you went and told your folks tomorrow at work, man, you won't believe what Pastor Travis did. He threw out the money changers and the pigeons at church today. Your friend would go, wait a minute, why are there money changers and pigeons in your church? Right? That's weird to us, right? So we got to answer that question. So here's how we're going to answer it. Number one, you have to remember structure and size of the temple. The temple is huge. The entire temple platform is 34 acres big. That's going to be important in a minute. It's the temple mount, as it's called, the entire thing. 34. Some historians even say it could be up to 40 acres. Regardless, it's huge. Jesus is not, and remember, the way the temple is structured is it's increasingly smaller. So it's this big area that's 34 acres. Then there's a part that anybody can go in, the outer part. It's called the Court of Gentiles. Then there's another section that's a little bit smaller that all of Israel can go in. It's called the Court of Women. And then there's a smaller space that all the men can go in called the Court of Israel. And then there's a smaller space called the Court of Priests that only priests can go in. And then you have the actual temple proper, the actual building of the temple. And only priests can go in that. And remember, inside of that, there's two parts. And only the high priest can go in the Holy of Holies, which is where the Ark of the Covenant is, right? Jesus isn't in this little narrow spot, right, that only the men can go in. Jesus is in the Court of Gentiles. He's in the biggest section, right, which everybody had to get to if you were going to keep going further, closer to the temple. So it is a massive area. Now, why? And remember, the temple structure. What is the temple? What is the purpose of the temple? The temple is there to help people worship God. That's the sole purpose. To help people grow in relationship. And it was supposed to aid in people worshiping God. Now, with that in mind, we can ask, why are there money changers in the temple? All right, you got to think. It's Passover week. Remember we talked last week about how big the city had gotten population-wise on an event like this? Tripled or quadrupled or whatever five times is. Quintupled. Is that right? I think so. Sounds good to me. All right. Quintupled in size. And so people from all over were coming to the temple for Passover. But while they were there, they were going to pay their temple tax. Taxes back in the old days as well. Every Jewish man 20 years or older was required to pay the temple tax. Okay? It was to help fund the operation of the temple. They were required to pay like one shekel. I think that's what it was. One shekel. And so, but if you come in and you don't have the money that the temple accepts, what you got to do? You got to exchange your money for the money the temple accepts. The temple accepted what was known as the Tyrian, T-Y-R-I-A-N, Tyrian shekel. You want to know why? It contained the highest percentage of silver. Makes sense, right? They didn't want a devalued coin. They wanted more precious metal, right? So they accepted the Tyrian shekel. So if you came from Ethiopia for Passover and you have whatever currency was in Ethiopia, you had to exchange it for the Tyrian shekel to then pay your temple tax. Now, there was a small fee associated with that, right? Just like if you exchange currency anywhere else. There may be a small fee except. Now, why are there animals? Pigeons. Other gospels tell us there's other animals there as well. Why are there animals? Because if you're traveling, even from Galilee where Jesus lived, and you were going to bring your Passover lamb with you to eat at Passover, like was required by Moses in Exodus, God gave the instruction in Exodus, you know what that lamb had to be? Spotless and perfect. And you're on a 3-day walk. What happens if your precious little lamb that you have bottle fed and raised up, that is going to be your Passover lamb, breaks a leg on the way there? Guess what? You no longer have a Passover dinner. You might have dinner, but you don't have Passover dinner because he's got a broke leg now. So it would make sense that you would just purchase your animal there. Or if you were going and you knew you weren't right with the Lord because you did some bad stuff and you needed to offer a sacrifice for your sins, again, that had to be spotless and perfect, it's a whole lot easier if I just buy my animal there that I'm going to give as a sacrifice to cover my sins so that I can be in right standing with the Lord. Because what if you bring that precious little animal that you think's perfect, but when you get up there and the priest has to inspect it, he's like, oh, you see that spot right there on its tail? Sorry. Then you just not only carried an animal with you, but you got to take care of that animal for your entire time and then purchase one anyway. So it was really a service. That's why they're in there. But what does Jesus do? Jesus says, y'all going to get on out of here, right? And he shoos them all out, right? He throws them out. Now, why does he do that? Again, if it's a service that, you know, why does he do what Jesus tells us? Let's read verse 13 again. Okay. This, as he's shooing folk out, here's what he says. It is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you make it into a den of robbers. Now, Jesus is quoting Isaiah 56:7 specifically. And I would encourage you to go back and read all of Isaiah 56. Why? Because remember, we don't read verses, we read paragraphs, right? And when you read Isaiah 56, here's what you will see. In that passage, Isaiah is speaking God's words to the people. And in that passage, God is declaring salvation not to Israel, but to the foreigners. He is basically saying, hey, foreigners, you don't have to worry. If you're a Gentile and you follow after me and you follow my rules, I will save you. And one day, all of God's people will come into my house, i.e. the temple, and you will worship there. Right? My house shall be called a house of prayer that all people, Jew and Gentile, will come into. So Jesus says, that's what it ought to be, but what have you done? Made it into a den of robbers. Fascinating, right? So what does that phrase, den of robbers, mean? We're going to look at it in one way here and another way in just a moment. One commentator put it best. Well, I'm going to read you two commentator quotes here. One said it this way. Jesus complains that the same sellers and exchangers have turned the temple precinct into a den of robbers. We usually take this phrase, and listen, we usually take this phrase to mean that these sellers and exchangers are thieves in a monetary sense. I'm going to tell you a story from my own life about how that played out in church life in a minute. The phrase den of robbers focuses on zealotry, not finances. In other words, by setting up the court, by setting up in the court of Gentiles, the sellers and exchangers are excluding the Gentiles from the ability to come to God in prayer, worship, and service. C.K. Barrett stated it this way: they have turned the temple into a nationalistic stronghold. In other words, Jesus is, listen to me carefully, Jesus is not getting onto them because they are stealing money. He is getting onto them because they are stealing space. In other words, they're making it inaccessible for non-Jewish people to come into the temple to worship God. Not money, space. Okay? So, God's house was to be a house of prayer and sacrifice for everyone instead of being confronted. as one commentator wrote, with brokenness and contrition, holy adoration and prolonged petition, there was noisy commerce. Again, it's not that commerce was the issue. It's that the commerce was excluding people for what the temple was really set up to help them do. Right? Okay, let's keep going. Verse 14. What happens in verse 14? The blind and the lame came to him, Jesus, in the temple, and he healed them. So in other words, Jesus drives all these exchangers and sellers out, and then who comes to him? The people who do not normally have access to the temple. The blind and the lame. Why? Because they're blind and they're lame. Do you realize that if you, listen carefully, do you realize that if you were blind, lame, had eczema, some other skin condition, or had other issues that you might normally face, you would be excluded from worship in the temple. And so what does Jesus do? He immediately rights the ship for that moment. Because the people who shouldn't have access to the temple, he's now like, all right, y'all are out of here. Y'all come on in. Y'all are the ones who need to be in here. And what does he do? He heals them immediately, and now they have access to worship of the Lord. So the blind and the lame come in. He pushes out the exchangers and sellers, brings in the blind and the lame. Okay. Now, verse 15, about to get tense, because who notices what's going on in 15 and 16? Well, it's the religious elite, those who were in charge of running the temple. And so in verse 15, Jesus is there doing his thing. And look what it says. But when the chief priests and the scribes saw the, look what Matthew says, wonderful things, right? It's wonderful. Healing the blind and the lame. Look what happens. The children, like literally, the kids who were there, what do they start crying out? What they heard their parents screaming out the day before. Kids ain't dumb. Right? They was there. One little three-year-old was probably going with that palm branch, you know, overactive three-year-old. I know, I can see it. Probably a boy going. And his mom like, stop it, right? And so, what's he doing on Monday? Hosanna to the Son of David, right? Praise the Lord. This is the Messiah. And what did the religious elite do? Look at the word. They were indignant. Now, that's not a word we use a whole lot, so I had to do a little research. What I found out is fascinating. All right, the word indignant literally means to shake, shudder, or quiver. Listen to this, though. The Greek writer Plutarch used this word to describe what happens during the fermentation process of beer. What does the liquid, when it's fermenting, do? It shakes and it bubbles. So it looks like the liquid is what? Moving and shaking. So what were these people doing?
They weren't just going, they were. You ever been so mad you just like, you get the shakes? That's what they were doing. They weren't just like, oh man, Jesus, stop that. They were like veins popping out of their necks and heads. They were shaking their, somebody had to be, you know, pointing his finger, you know, and all of this. So listen to me. Here's another question. Why were they so mad? All right, we got to go back to that phrase, den of robbers. Okay? They see what's going on. Jesus is throwing all out all the money exchangers, all the people. The blind and lame are coming in. And then he has the audacity to say, God's house is supposed to be a house of prayer, but you have made it into a den of robbers. Well, who's the you? These guys. The people who run the temple. The religious elite. Now, here's what I didn't tell you earlier. That word, robber, does not mean thief, like I steal something from you. It actually means insurrectionist. Anybody remember a famous insurrectionist in the Holy Week story? Barabbas, right? What was Barabbas called? An insurrectionist? Same word here. Insurrectionist. Now, think of it this way. What does it mean to be what did Jesus say? My house be a house of prayer. You have made it into a den of insurrectionism. What does the word den mean there? Think about it. Safe haven. What do we call the place that a mother fox houses her kids, I believe? A den. What do we call a place that a bear, mama bear, raises the cubs? A safe haven. So let's put it together. What did Jesus just say? You guys have made this place a safe haven of insurrection. Whoa, that sounds a whole lot worse than den of robbers. But here's the next question we got to ask. Who are they insurrecting from? Think about it. Right? If it's you have made the temple a safe haven of insurrection, who are you insurrecting from? Because if it's Barabbas he's insurrectionist against the Romans. But who are the chief priests and religious leaders and the people who are behind the temple system, who are they insurrecting from? Well, it can't be the Romans, because the Romans don't give two hoots and a holler about the temple. As long as they get their money, right? Tax money, give money. Y'all do whatever you want to in there. So it's not that. So there's only other one logical choice. It's God. So what did Jesus just do? He said, listen to me very carefully. He said, this place is supposed to be leading people to God of all nations, and you are setting up a mafia-like safe haven of insurrection that is keeping people from God. Whoa. And guess what? The chief priests, the reason they were indignant is because they got the message. Jesus just said, hey guys, you think you're doing this thing over here, but here's what you're actually doing by your actions. You say this over here, but your actions show us that you religiously are hijacking God's intended plan for the temple for your own personal gain. In other words, they were using the temple as a safe haven to do whatever they want. Thus, they are robbing God. Listen, they are robbing God of the means by which His blessing extends to all the nations. Doesn't have anything. Look, it has nothing to do with finances. Really. It has to do with taking something and co-opting it from what God wanted it to be to what you want it to be. Right? So, what happens after this? He quotes to them Psalm 8:2, and then in verse 17, he leaves. Now, we got to wrap this up. We're 9 minutes over already. So, let's ask the question.
All right. We get what happened. Do you get what happened? Jesus walks into the temple. He throws everybody out. He says, my house is supposed to be for worship and prayer and to, for all nations, but you have made it into a mafia-like safe haven of nationalistic insurrectioning against God. You have devalued what God is trying to do in the hearts and lives of people here. In fact, you've made it somewhat impossible for them to even get there. Right? So, how in the world does this apply to us? Today I'm going to give you a very quick story of why, how this story has been hijacked by us today. Several years ago, at a church that I previously served at, not here, previous church, just want to be clear, right? And so the person who's like their side of the equation that I'm talking with said, hey, here's what we only ask. If you could please feed the kids before we come, got that taken care of. And then he said, hey, if we can have to take up a love offering after church, and if we can set up some merchandise. Now remember, Ugandan children's choir lived in an orphanage in Uganda. Keep that in mind. I was like, absolutely. He's like, we got CDs. The girls made these like hand-woven little bracelet things and some like giraffes that they had carved out of wood. I was like, that was easy, absolutely. Well, the lowly youth pastor got told that it wasn't okay for them to sell their merchandise in the foyer of the church. But they could do it in the office that was literally right behind the sanctuary. And sometimes I can, you know, the flesh kind of creeps out a little bit, you know. And I'm like, huh? And they're like, yeah, you know, we can't be buying and selling in church. And I was like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I was like, why? Do you know what their reasoning was? This story right here. And I was like, you got to be kidding me, right? He's like, you know, some deacon guy was like, no, like, buying and selling in church. I was like, well, one of us about to win. Now, I'm not sure who it is going to be yet, but like, this is dumb. Though, you know, they had to set up in back there. Because, you know, he's just a lowly youth pastor, you know, nobody was, you know, set up out there. You know how many people went back there? About five. So I made it my mission to let everybody know this was the stupidest rule I'd ever heard. In fact, so far that in a next deacon's meeting, you know, I didn't go to many, like they didn't let me in. So how do we apply this story correctly today? Now look, I'm going to be honest with you. This is going to step on somebody's toes. And I'm going to start with the one that's going to step on our toes the most. Not all of us, but some of us. Here's the question I asked myself this week. How could we hijack the mission of this church like the chief priests were doing? All right, so that's the question I asked. Because remember, what did they do? They had taken the temple and made it into a nationalistic stronghold. And they were, which was keeping God from being able to do what he wanted to do in their church. So I said, okay, if we were the chief priests, what would that look like today? You ready? Flags, hats, clothes. Here's one that's going to step on your toes. Just listen to me. Because some of us are proud Southerners. Do you know what it would look like in our church if we were doing what the chief priests were doing? We would have Confederate flags in our church. Because what would that say? If you ain't like us, we don't want you here. Oh, right. I would be willing to bet that the majority of us in this room had people in our family, if we go back far enough, that fought in the Civil War on the Confederate side, right? But if we put Confederate flags up in here, no better than chief priests. Now, that's the... Let me give you a little bit easier one that we could probably all agree on. Churches that fly LGBTQ+ flags are doing the exact same thing
the chief priests are doing. You want to know why? Because if you don't believe our ideology, you're not welcome here. That's what it says. They are intentionally keeping God from doing what God wants to do through His church when you do stuff like that. And that's two completely different ends of the spectrum. But both of them are saying the exact same thing. If you don't believe like us, you're not welcome here. And what is that inevitably doing? Keeping people from the outside to come inside where God can do what only He can do. Hats. Let me ask you a question. Serious question. Why is it okay? I was going to get Holly, if she was here, to wear her new cowboy hat just for this point. Why is it okay for girls to wear hats in church, ladies to wear hats in church, but not guys? Seriously, find me a Bible verse that says men can't wear hats in church. Can I give you a hint? You're not going to find one. And some of you might want to go to that head covering passage in Corinthians. We can have a conversation about that one. Okay? But you want to know what happened in another church I served in? Had an old, he sat right over there. Not Mr. Ronald. But he sat over there, over that way. Kind of where, about where Tanner's asleep at. And he gave one of my 11th grade students up the country because he wore a hat on Sunday night. Now, could the student have just said, okay, and I'll take it off? But the student was like, no, my mama said I can wear this hat. And you know what happened? I caught them down in the other building because the teenagers kind of left. That dude left, followed him, and he was like this in that teenager's face over a hat. But if a girl had wore a hat, it would have been okay. Right? Is that biblical or is that cultural? Cultural, not biblical. So, do you give somebody up the country for wearing a hat? Just know, we're going to have words. It don't matter to me. That's not what's important. Clothes. My mother, love her to death, she would have tanned my hide if I'd have wore shorts to church. You want to know why? It's a good reason. I don't even know why. You just don't wear shorts to church. But why, Mama? Why? It's hot. In the summer, no shorts. Do you know when I was a teenager, in high school, the only time I got to wear shorts, the only time was when I had left football practice, was sweaty and stanky, and barely had enough time to leave school and get to church. I could wear shorts then. If not, you know what we wore? Khaki pants and a polo on Wednesday night. Oh, God. Why?
I don't know.
That's a great question. I never found that verse in the Bible. Right? So look, listen to me. If you want to wear shorts, that's between you and your family. Now, let's all be modest and dressed appropriately. Like, I think that's biblical. But like, if you want to wear a tie, that's feel free. I'm not wearing one. But if you want to, that's fine. Ladies, if you want to wear pants or a dress or short, hey, look, that's between you and your family. But when we make flags more important than the gospel, hats more important than the gospel, and shorts more important than the gospel, we are no better than the chief priests. So, we'll say this Sunday what I said last Sunday. Instead of fighting God on all this stuff, why don't we just join His team? It's a whole lot better for all of us. Because then we know we're about His mission, not our own mission.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.